Good morning. This is the special session on the Ebola virus disease epidemic. My name is Barry Levy, and together with Carol Easley Allen, who's just finishing up an earlier session, together we have organized the session, and with the assistance of a lot of people, we will be moderating the session. As many of you know, the Ebola virus disease epidemic is one of the greatest public health challenges of our time. It apparently began in Guinea about 8 months ago, although we're not exactly sure of the time and the place. It has been most intense in Guinea, Sierra Leone, and Liberia. It's really unclear what direction the epidemic is going. There's some evidence that it is decreasing, that the number of new cases is decreasing in Liberia, increasing in Sierra Leone, and perhaps staying steady in Guinea. There have been reported 13,000 cases and 5,000 deaths, although those of us who have worked in epidemic control and disease surveillance know that the actual numbers are probably far, far higher. There have been introductions of cases, as we'll hear this morning, in Nigeria and also in Senegal and Mali. Those introductions have been controlled with basic public health measures of contact tracing, sometimes tracing over 100 contacts of individual cases, isolation and quarantine. However, there's been a second introduction recently, as many of you know, in Mali, and it's unclear what the ultimate consequences of that will be. Of course, there's also been introduction of some cases, mainly in returning healthcare workers, introducing cases in the United States and Western Europe that have largely been controlled. We're going to keep our introductions of speakers relatively short this morning so we could hear from the speakers primarily. There'll be a question and answer period in the last part of this session. So would you like, Carol, to introduce Timothy Robertson, our first speaker?
Timothy Robertson is a doctoral candidate for a degree, Doctor of Public Health at Johns Hopkins University. He has worked with the Red Cross in Guinea, so please help me in welcoming him.
Thanks very much, Carol. My name is Tim Robertson. I'm at Johns Hopkins School of Public Health, and I was lucky enough in July to go for a few weeks to Guinea, to Conakry and Gekedu, on behalf of the International Federation of the Red Cross and Red Crescent Societies. Our work was to evaluate the work of the Guinea Red Cross, who have a large number of volunteers doing social mobilization, dead body management, and disinfection. And a lot of what we looked at was sort of internal operational issues, but we also took away a lot of lessons learned just about the work that these volunteers are doing in general, which is applicable, I think, not just for the Red Cross, but for other agencies, and not just in Guinea, but throughout West Africa. What I want to put to you today is that one of the reasons why the Ebola outbreak has progressed the way it has is because people, families, were slow and reluctant to adopt behavior change messages. But they did this for understandable reasons. People in Guinea didn't respond irrationally. They responded for logical reasons in the way that perhaps you and I would respond. And I think the more we can appreciate and acknowledge the way these people have acted and the reasons for their actions, then I think the more successful we're going to be at bringing this outbreak to an end. So, let's get straight into it. If we think about controlling Ebola in terms of the paradigm of treatment and prevention, I would argue that Ebola treatment has received most of the attention, both in the literature and in the press. There's been less evidence on prevention and its implications at the community level for a number of reasons. For us now, Ebola prevention means behavior change. We don't yet have a vaccine that we know of, although there are some promising developments. The Guinea Red Cross in Guinea is the major actor for behavior change activities. They have, like I said, hundreds of volunteers throughout the country from different villages and from urban areas who are conducting behavior change activities to educate families throughout the country about how they can protect themselves and stop the transmission of the disease. So, myself and a colleague were there for just over 2 weeks. We did qualitative research among Guinea Red Cross staff and volunteers in Conakry and Gekedu, which, as Barry said, was where we believe the outbreak started. We did more than this, but for the data that I'm presenting today, we did 10 interviews with staff and volunteers and then some focus groups. I want to talk about three things that we found in our results. Firstly, just a quick overview of who the Red Cross volunteers are and what they're doing, and then looking at the challenges that they face and some of the strategies that they themselves have developed for building relationships with communities and overcoming these challenges. Okay, so like I said, when we were there, there were 750 volunteers throughout the country who had been trained and who were active. And I believe there's many more there who are active now because more have been recruited. Most of them were quite young, 20 to 40, both men and women. And not many of them had much health experience, although they'd worked on immunization campaigns or on cholera outbreaks. The supervisors were often nurses, but the volunteers themselves didn't have any formal health training. We call them volunteers because they're not paid usually, but they were receiving a stipend for the activities they're doing now. So this is just to give you a bit of a visual. This is us with some Red Cross volunteers just outside of Conakry. And these volunteers are doing, the Red Cross mainly doing communication and social mobilization, so going door to door in villages to talk to families and educate them about the disease and how they can protect themselves and their families, doing dead body management. That is, when somebody dies of Ebola in the community or suspected of dying from Ebola, a team of, say, four volunteers would go out to that community, would talk to the family, and then would dress in their protective gear, and then clean the body, and then safely bury the body, and then do disinfection, disinfect the house or the room where the person was last sleeping with chlorine. So now we get into the sort of key findings here. What challenges do they face? So this is really qualitative research. So I'm going to put up a few quotes for you and just to paint a picture of some of the challenges people face. This paragraph here to me is indicative of the challenges in general. You know, when we were there, we talked about, the volunteers talked about, you know, most villages, people understand, they get it and they're very helpful and they listen to us. But there are these some villages, there are these reticent, resistant villages where people either don't believe that Ebola exists yet, or they're reluctant to work with us, or they're just outright hostile to us. So this is a story here of one village where the volunteers went. They knew that, they suspected someone had died from Ebola because the village didn't want them in. They didn't believe that it was Ebola, and they said they didn't need any help. So the community themselves buried the body. And then as a result, you can imagine a person is most infectious when they die. And in Kisi culture, in that part of Guinea, it's customary for families and other people to all be involved in cleaning the body. Okay? And so you can imagine that's just a recipe for disaster in terms of transmitting the disease to other family members and that. So unless it's done safely, it can be very dangerous. And so this is evidently what happened here. But then eventually, when so many more people died, they sort of reached out to the Red Cross and sought their help again. So there's general disbelief in that people, well, at least at the time, so remember this is back in July, so things may have changed now, although I wouldn't be surprised if there are still some villages like this. But people just didn't believe that the disease exists or existed, and for many reasons, because they just assumed that it was political talk, that it was the government trying to raise money at that time, or the humanitarian organizations trying to raise money. Some people, this second quote here, talks about how at the start there were lots of messages given to community members about not eating certain animals, and that these animals were problematic. That's changed now because most of the transmission is human to, well, pretty much all the transmission is human to human. But because people have been eating these animals for so long, they couldn't understand why that was suddenly problematic. And then other people have talked about how these rumors about the Red Cross themselves being involved, and that they were doing this because they were just out to make money, or that they wanted to steal body parts. There's some quotes here. And lastly, the other challenge or the issue that created problems was that the protective actions of the Red Cross volunteers around burial and dead body management were at odds with people's local cultures and customs. And this created problems because people, you know, after centuries of burying their dead in this way, were reluctant to suddenly change because of a disease that they still weren't quite sure existed. So these are some of the challenges that people face in the communities. And now I'll talk a little bit about the strategies that they developed to overcome these challenges. Perhaps the strongest strategy that people soon developed was this idea of involving community leaders, meaning politicians, religious leaders, local elders, in the discussion and bringing them on board as advocates and working with them. So this quote talks about how even before they would step foot in a village, they would go get the person from the health centre, they would talk to the village chief, and then sort of form a delegation to then go around and talk to people in the village. Another strategy was that at the time of burial, instead of dressing up in PPE and cleaning the body in an enclosed room, they would ask one of the family members if they themselves wanted to dress up, and they would have a little quick training session on training that the family member how to dress up, and then they would ask that family member to come in into the room and watch what they were doing. And that way, that family member could then go report to their family and say, you know what, this is legit, this is what they're doing, and I didn't see anything that was dodgy. Another little strategy here is the idea of just being sensitive to people's customs. For example, people being buried with their possessions. So even though now with Ebola they're using body bags, you can still put people's possessions inside that body bag and then still give them the opportunity to pray over the body, even if it's from a distance. So basically being as willing as possible to incorporate people's traditional customs into this sort of safe process for Ebola dead body management. A final strategy here, one of the volunteers talked about in some villages people were so hostile that really all they could do was go around and talk to people one-on-one, and they wouldn't do any community meetings or anything like that. So in conclusion, I just wanted to put up a few discussion points about what I think are the takeaway messages from this. The first is that, you know, we need people in communities to adopt protective behaviours, but these protective behaviours have profound implications for families. It's not a simple, easy thing to tell a mother that she can't touch her sick child if the child has a fever. That is an incredible thing to ask people to do, as is asking people to overturn centuries of traditional customs around burial and that sort of thing. So we've got to remember that what we're asking people to do has profound implications, and that for this reason, people were reluctant to embrace these new ways of behaving, and that's sort of understandable. If we want to convince families to adopt these behaviours, though, we need to build trust, and that takes time, you know. I think if any of us in our neighbourhoods were to suddenly go and knock on the next-door neighbours or the other people down the street where we live and say, oh, by the way, I just wanted to let you know that there's this new disease out, and, you know, if your kid is getting sick, you can't touch the kid. You know, if we'd done that last year, most people would think we're crazy, you know. So it takes, there's a process here that needs to happen of building trust and relationships with the community members. And my final slide here is that, well, what's the way forward? I think the way forward is to continue to use these community volunteers, but we need to recognise that the support advocacy that needs to come with that. We can't just send people out into villages to educate people like that. We need to make sure they're well trained and supervised. We need to make sure they develop innovative strategies. And we need support and advocacy from the entire community. That means community leaders, politicians, religious leaders, and from their health system as well. So that's what I have to say. I want to acknowledge the IFRC for funding and initiating the trip. And thank you for listening to me. Thank you.